From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last fall, when a painting possibly by Leonardo da Vinci sold for $450 million, it was confirmed. The art market is going nuts right now, particularly for contemporary art. Paintings are going for tens of millions of dollars. Collectors, maybe you could call them investors, are clearly in a mood to buy, so dealers are making a lot of money, but are the artists themselves? Well, some of them. Nathaniel Kahn's new film at Sundance this year is about that relationship between art and money. So he's asking, can the real value of art be measured by its price tag? Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about his film. It's called The Price of Everything. Join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The filmmaker Nathaniel Kahn grew up surrounded by artists, and he says with all of them, along with their gifts and their rewards, come demons. The demons are different for everyone, except, he says, for one. Artists all share one demon in common. It's money. Money, he says, can reveal a weakness. If you chase it, you can lose your way. If you ignore it, you can end up with nothing. Kahn has a film in the competition at Sundance this year that explores this relationship between art and money, and he's picked the perfect time for it. The art market right now is on fire, particularly for contemporary art. Collectors or investors are spending hundreds of millions of dollars. And in this film, he kind of parses the difference between a collector and an investor, if there is one, because it's really about how you measure the value of art and how money drives the art world in good ways and not so good ways. As one curator puts it in the film, you wouldn't have the golden age without the gold. The film also gets at the nature of art. It's called The Price of Everything. We're in the studios of community radio station KPCW talking with Nathaniel Kahn about the film. His 2003 documentary film about his father, the architect Louis I. Kahn, was nominated for an Academy Award. His new film is called The Price of Everything, as I said, and we'll give you some details about the screenings of the film a little bit later on the program. Nathaniel Kahn, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here with you.
I guess I wanted to begin with the question. You've talked about how that relationship between money and art has always fascinated you.
Sure.
Why?
Well, I saw it as a young person. It wasn't just my parents. My mother is also involved in the arts. She's a landscape architect. But I have an uncle who was a sculptor, and I had an aunt who was a painter and a sculptor. And I have two sisters, both of whom are artists, one a painter and one a musician. So, and I myself am involved in the arts.
For sure.
And we all struggle with money, you know, and I saw it with, you know, with the generation before me and how my father struggled with it was really, you know, I mean, in my film, My Architect, I talk about it intimately. He died $450,000 in debt. And in 1974, that was a lot of money. And it weighed heavily on him. It never stopped him from pursuing his dream, which was to make great art. That's, you know, it makes me emotional just thinking about it because I know a little bit now, being the age that I am, what he must have been going through, realizing you're doing the best work of your life and you can't pay the bills. And I think in many ways that's responsible for his death. You know, I mean, that was just a terrible, terrible strain and struggle. That's something that I've carried with me, I guess, all these years, is this feeling that the relationship between art and money and artists and money is very, very complex. And this film is, in many ways, an exploration of that. And that's, I mean, that's from the very title. The Price of Everything is half of the quote by Oscar Wilde, which is, nowadays people know the price of everything and the value
nothing.
Of nothing. Yeah. You know the quote.
Yeah.
So it seemed like the right title part, and we struggled with the title. As I said, for a while we thought it could be called From Poons to Coons because they're two artists who are in the film, and you know, they're very, very different. This seemed like the right title because it also implies the price, not just the financial price, but the human price of making art. And there is a high one. And those of us who are engaged in that in that pursuit need to be able to pay that price. And Jerry Saltz actually mentions it in the very early in the film. Marvel's critic who's in the film, Jerry Saltz, who says, you know, don't be an artist unless you really, 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 really have to, because 99.9% of the artists out there don't make money.
That's right.
And that is something that we tend to forget, because we see these numbers, you know, $450 million for a laydown. I mean, granted, he's not going to get any of it, okay? He's been dead for quite a number of centuries.
Well, that's the big question anyway. Who's going to get this really in terms of the artists too? That comes up as a –
That does come up. And that's a very big thing. But, you know, but we do tend to – you know, we do tend to think that, okay, this is the golden moment of art because look at all the money that's around. Yeah. And it's true that there is a lot of money around, and a lot of high profile artists are selling at a lot of high profile sales, and high profile collectors are buying them, and it's all terribly exciting. But that doesn't change the fact that most of the artists out there are struggling. And even the ones who do make a lot of money are struggling, because they have to put that out of their mind. If they're thinking about that when they're making the art, it can be over really fast.
Yeah.
Because then suddenly you can pick up on that. It's not that the viewer picks up on it. The art picks up on it. The painting will show it, or the sculpture will show it. Ah, you've done that before. That's not new.
But that's the thing I think that is so great about the film, is it really explores the kind of ecosystem of the way this world works.
Yes, yes.
And on one hand, let me play this moment actually from the film. Yes. This is right at the top of the film. This is the auctioneer Simon Dupuy. Mm. Talking about, well, essentially what you were just saying.
Sure.
How art, as he says, and money go hand in hand.
$1 million on the telephone here. $1,100,000.
Art and money have always gone hand in hand.
$1,200,000.
It's very important for good art to be expensive.
And $1,400,000, $1,500,000, $1,600,000, now $1,700,000. It's $2 million. I'm going to sell.
You only protect things that are valuable.
The fabulous Frank Stella. $2,200,000.
If something has no financial value, people don't care.
$3,800,000.
$4 million.
$4,800,000.
$5 million.
They will not give it the necessary protection.
David Hurst at $9 million. Mr. Gail Rickard, $13 million. $13,500,000.
$15 million. Any more than
$16 million. $17 million. $17,500,000.
I love that element because it gives you the sense of the pace of the film, the thing that's driving it. And often it's these auction figures and that come down on these massive numbers. But this gives you a sense of what I think is so interesting about the role of money. On one hand, Simon says, it protects art. It makes it valuable. So we
sure.
And in some ways it – and then the other thing that comes up in the film also is that money in some way, or value – drives innovation. It drives artists thinking of it. But then there's the other part of it, which is at what point does it start to corrupt the whole process? This seems to be what it's about.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you played that for a couple reasons. One is that it is the opening sequence of the film. It's the title sequence of the film too. But it's driven by this incredible score by Jeff Beal. And you hear it in the background. It's like a waltz. It is a you're on the merry-go-round, right? And Jeff is a marvelous composer. He did House of Cards, among other wonderful scores, and the score for Pollock, which is, of course, a masterpiece. He knows art intimately, and he got it immediately that this needs to feel like we're in this dance. We're in a dance, and it's the dance of art and money. And in many ways, the film is the dance between art and money. Simone's comment, and Simone is an incredible character. I mean, he's an auctioneer extraordinaire. He actually does a lot of charity work too. I mean, he's a very principled man, but he's definitely in the game in a big way. And he has that perfect accent to go with it, you know.
Right.
He's from Switzerland. And he actually wanted to be an artist, which is a marvelous story we didn't have a chance to get into, but he wanted to be an artist and he became this great auctioneer. But he asserts something right up front here, which is that great art has to cost a lot of money because we humans only protect things if they're valuable. Now, we present it straight ahead in the beginning of the film. In many ways, we spend the entire film questioning that, interrogating that idea. The film is a grand interrogation of that idea.
In a literal way, too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
From your perspective.
Oh, from my perspective. Very much so. And I think that, but very quickly after that, Larry Poons makes his appearance in his upstate New York farm, which is, you know, it's definitely rustic. And he has this incredible studio, which I'll let you talk about and describe, because you'll describe it beautifully. But Larry says right away, he absolutely asserts the counter idea, which is he says, art and money have no intrinsic hookup at all. And that's absolutely how he feels it. He says, you know, it's a marvelous comment. He said, you know, it's not like your batting average. Your batting average is your batting average. It's not true with art. How much art costs is not necessarily a value of its worth. So he absolutely, you know, would disagree entirely with what Simone says.
What's interesting, let's talk about Larry, because I want to play actually that moment. Mm. Larry Poons was with the titans of contemporary art when contemporary art, as you lay out in the film, strikes in the 70s.
Yes.
It goes mad. Jasper Johns and Rauschenberg and Pollock and all of those. And Larry Poons is among them. He's
absolutely
right there.
In the 60s, really.
In the 60s, the exactly.
Yeah.
In the 60s.
Yep.
But then he sort of disappears. Mm. He, as one great collector, and we'll get to him in a moment, says he slides off the ledge.
Mm-hmm.
And you find him in, as you say, in upstate New York. Is it upstate New York?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he is trying to keep his integrity as an artist. He wants to keep changing.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not in the same line with some of those people who have made millions, tens of millions of dollars.
Sure.
Let me play this moment because
this
gets at this this thing that you were talking about. And it also conveys, and I wanted you to say something about this, your style, that mm-hmm. you are basically interrogating all of these people that we hear you as part of the process of the film.
Yes, my voice is there. I like to have encounters with people. Really what we're doing is we're both improvising. It's like jazz.
Yeah.
But in order for me to do it, it's essential that I work with my marvelous camera people and sound people, because these are people who dance with me. We are all together with the subject playing some jazz, and whatever happens kind of happens. And then we go back. But this encounter with Larry, which you're about to play, this happened just, we drove up, he started talking, and we were there.
So, Larry?
Yeah.
How do you start to learn how to see?
You don't. You don't. You didn't decide who your parents were. It's the same thing.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, you don't decide certain things. You don't decide, you don't pick your parents, and you don't pick who you are.
Was that what it was like for you finding painting?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I tried to, yeah. I wanted to be an artist. Now, an artist can be anything. You know, a poet, a writer, a singer, you know, Hank Williams. It's what you do, what you can do.
What's the relationship between art and money?
Art and money have no intrinsic hookup at all. It's not like sports. Your batting average is your batting average. You know, that's the bottom line, you know. And they've tried to make it much like that. Like, the best artist is the most expensive artist. Same thing.
Is that not true?
How could it be true?
Marvelous.
Right? He really is.
It comes through without even the pictures. You hear it in his voice. I mean, this is a beautiful human being.
Yeah.
And a great artist.
Yeah.
And you mentioned several things about him. It's not like he hasn't been noticed all these years. He's the artist's artist. Artists know about Larry Poons. They know about the things that he's done since those famous dot paintings in the 60s.
Right. But collectors don't yet.
Well, some do.
Some are,
some
right?
Do. Oh, absolutely.
But I think this is the central tension of the, at least for Larry's part of the thing, film, is he seems like he's at a moment to break out.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, yes, and of course, we don't want to give everything away, but actually, he's not here right now at Sundance. He desperately wanted to be here at Sundance, but he's having a show in Barcelona.
Wow.
So, of his new paintings. So, he has incredible new paintings, which you may talk about soon, but Larry is a guy who, we're talking about somebody who, from the 70s, really, has been, you know, painting, doing his own work, following his own star, with not always the approval at all, or the acceptance, certainly not of the market, but he has kept going. And for me, it's interesting because I myself have felt a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned my architect. You mentioned my film from 2003, 2004. which was a huge success.
Yep.
What is it now? 2018. I've done lots of work between then.
But people are wondering, where's Nathaniel?
Sure. Been? Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I mean, I made a wonderful film about Leon Fleischer, the pianist, you know, that did well. And but, you know, whatever. For whatever reason, there's
what have been, you done for me lately?
What have I done for me lately?
Yeah.
And I know what that feels like because you see lots of people do, you know, there's so much luck involved, right? But you have to keep going. And where does that strength come from to keep going? Mm. It has to come from within. It cannot. If you're looking for it from without, if you're looking for it from the market, from your prices, from people telling you you're fabulous all the time, you're 99% chance, unless you're incredibly lucky and you just have this sailing career, you're going to flop because you have to find that strength from within. And that's what Larry represents for me, is that the true spirit of the artist is someone who just has to make the art because, as he says in the quote, very beginning, I wanted to be an artist. And an artist can be anything. Could be singer, could be Hank Williams. And of course, we find out later that Larry is actually a singer, plays guitar very well.
That's amazing.
Was in a band with he was in Andy Warhol's band, by the way.
No way.
Yeah. You can find the music. The band was called The Druds.
Wow.
I'm not going to vouch for their musicality.
Yeah.
But anyway, he is a heck of a musician. And he just has this, he radiates the spirit of an artist. So the moment I met him, I said, okay, this guy, you know.
Let me play one more moment before we head into a break between you and Larry Poons.
Most people think it's like putting makeup on. You know, you got to be careful. Get close to a Rembrandt and you see how quickly things were done. Flick, 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 little flicks of color.
So when I say to people, I want to interview Larry Poons.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say,
why the fuck you weren't doing that? Yeah.
Or what happened to him? Where is he?
Yeah, I know.
Anyway?
They think I'm dead. Yeah. A lot of people have thought I was dead for a long time. Yeah. That's not my fault. My only defense against fate is color.
I think that's my favorite line of the film.
Magnificent.
Nathaniel Kahn is with us. He directed the documentary film The Price of Everything, which is showing in the U.S. documentary competition here at the 2018 Sundance Film Festival. It's going to be showing tomorrow night at 9 p.m. at the Park City Library, Friday evening at the Park City Municipal Athletic and Rec Center. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're back up in Park City talking with some of the filmmakers in the documentary competition at Sundance. Our conversation this time is about art and this question, are we in the midst of an art crisis? Nathaniel Kahn's film is about the modern art market, how it's booming, paintings and sculptures going for tens, hundreds of millions of dollars. But Kahn wants to know if you can really measure art in dollars. It turns out the answer might be maybe. This film is called The Price of Everything. He's joining us here in the studio today. And I want to talk about one of the great characters in the film, and this is Stefan Edlis.
Oh, yeah. Stefan. Incredible. He was here for the premiere.
Was he?
Oh, it was wonderful.
Oh, I can imagine. He loved being in the thick of it, right?
Yeah. He and his wife, Gail, were here, and it was just marvelous. In fact, the film, when we introduced him, everybody stood up and clapped for him because he's such a remarkable
character
and figure. 93 years old.
Okay, I was wondering how old he was. I mean, he is terrific. He's this Chicago-based collector, and he's absolutely in the thick of the art world. And what I love about him, let me play this moment from the film.
Sure.
Where there's this interplay between his real kind of honesty about art. On one hand, he just seems like this is an investment, but on the other hand, it seems like it's a passion. So it's that interplay that I think is really interesting. Here's another moment from the film, The Price of Everything.
There's a lot of money kicking around, and there is a limit to where you can put it. To be an effective collector, deep down, you have to be shallow. You have to be a decorator. You want the thing to work with the rugs, if you want it to work with the furniture. And I notice different styles of collecting. There is the collector that is the wolf in sheep's clothing, and then there is the sheep in wolf's clothing.
And everybody has their own style.
Which are you?
That's good. I can switch like the Donald. It all depends.
Wow. He's really great. I mean, talk a little bit about him, because in some way, on one hand, again, this seems like an investment. On the other hand, he really has an eye for it. And
oh yeah.
So what does he represent, Edlis, in the picture you're trying to create?
Well, Stefan is considered to be one of the most successful art traders, they're called, in the world today. And one thing we weren't really able to get into in the film, which is really fascinating, is that he he is a wealthy man, but that wealth, and he and his wife Gail both are collect together, and they talk about the decisions together and everything else. Their success, their financial success, is based almost entirely on art. He doesn't do other things. Art is his life. Art is their life.
They're surrounded by art.
Absolutely surrounded by it. And I think he feels very strongly another thing, that he does not collect things he doesn't like. I mean, as he says in this quote, you have to be a bit of a decorator. I mean, he's being coy too.
Sure.
Nevertheless, their apartment, they have several homes, but their apartment in Chicago is filled with the art that they have collected and that they love. He does not believe in storage. So many artists, and we also deal with this in the film, so many collectors buy things, stick them in storage, wait for a rainy day. It's kind of an investment. They put it away, they bring it out, or maybe they don't, or they trade it with someone else, or whatever it is. Or it even goes to a free port. That's a whole other thing now, where people buy things, they don't pay taxes. They don't even see the art. This is not Stefan. Stefan's a true collector. He buys things that he loves, and he doesn't. The buying is also tricky. We can talk about that. Anyway, he trades for things.
Right. He doesn't like to write checks.
Doesn't like to write checks, and
yeah.
He says so. Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There have been tax laws in place. There's some questioning going on about that, but there are tax laws in place in which art is treated like real estate.
Yeah.
Now that in and of itself makes my skin crawl.
Right.
As an idea. Right. I mean, how awful is that? Nevertheless, I will say this: that great collectors have used those laws to be able to build great collections. And sometimes those collections end up, you know, in storage, which is horrible. Sometimes they end up in their own places and never see the light of day, which is I also am not in love with. And sometimes we all benefit from them because they end up in museums. And I won't give away what happens in the film, but things do happen in the film, which are also let's just say the philanthropic side of all this, which is that great collectors can have an enormous impact on society if they turn their success into the public good. And that matters enormously. It does matter to Stefan, though one might not think that immediately.
Yeah, right? That's right. And we won't give that away.
No, I don't want to give it. But
the arc of that is great.
It is.
The way
true,
it works.
Very
and
true.
That is the question that comes up a lot. It's how much of this art should be set aside in a museum for everyone to have access to, and how much of this art should be on a wall in some wealthy hedge fund manager's apartment in New York.
Right.
And you work through that. And it seems like a complicated answer in some ways. There's one dealer that that you talk to, and we'll get back to this here in a moment, says, look, if all of these paintings went to museums, they'd end up in the basement.
Sure. No,
in
true.
A cemetery, I think. Is
right, right.
How
yes,
she,
yes, yes.
She
says
puts
cemetery.
It.
Yeah, right, right.
So this is a question you work through, too.
No, it's very complex. But I also think, you know, we are dealing with the art market here. So let's remember, the fact is art is a human drive, a human instinct. We all have it within us. Everyone has the artist in them. And I think that the art market can tend to skew our sort of sense of what art really is. It's this human desire to communicate and express. So ultimately, you know, yes, there are certain artists who are in hedge fund collections and in museums and all these things, but there are also many, many great artists who are not in those situations, who are collected by their friends and beloved. And sometimes those artists, after they're gone, and there's another marvelous artist, Marilyn Minter, who speaks about the fact that especially in the case, and it has been traditionally, luckily this is beginning to change, but not nearly fast enough, that for women especially, many times you're old or dead before you're recognized. Now, talk about unfair,
right?
You know, but the world is replete with stories like that. Look at Van Gogh. I mean, Van Gogh was actually very connected in the art world. His brother was a famous dealer, but even that couldn't make Marvelous Vincent be a wealthy man for these incredible paintings, which now grace the great museums in the world, and which you couldn't touch. Yeah. I mean, they're basically priceless.
That's right.
So it's a funny game, but I was very intrigued by this. And Stefan sort of is able to, he's a no-holds-barred guy. He tells it like it is.
He's great.
And he is, and he certainly has a certain taste, and his taste, he's a very aesthetic guy.
Very.
But he is also very much in the market.
Well, it's so interesting because there's this moment. I should just point out there he has a Jeff Koons rabbit piece.
Sure.
Rabbit from 1986.
Yep.
And you've probably seen it. It looks like a balloon animal rabbit, right?
That's right. Yes,
in
a balloon
stainless
animal,
steel.
And it's in stainless steel, and it's pristine.
It's pristine.
It's perfect.
And
yeah.
As Stefan points out to you in this exchange in the film, he says, I bought it in 91 for $945,000. And you say, how much is it worth now? And it is worth $65 million.
Yeah, at least. He actually underestimated. I'm not in this game, but I've heard much higher prices even.
And it's just sitting there in his apartment.
Sure, it's sitting there. But, well, interestingly enough, he's actually promised that to an institution.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
see, but this is the thing. This brings up Jeff Koons,
mm-hmm.
which is he's kind of the counter in some ways to Larry Poons, right?
Sure. Yeah.
As the prospective title for your film once was.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Right, right.
And he
yeah.
talks about how – and Jeff Koons is this – brilliant artist for sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But he's an artist who it seems he has created these systems.
Yep.
He was a former Wall Street guy
mm-hmm.
who understood the art of the deal.
Yep.
So art in that sense is such a part of commerce. It just seems like such an interesting contrast. And I wanted to have you talk about Jeff Koons, where he fits in the story.
Well, Jeff, I mean, Jeff is somebody I always wanted to talk to. Because my initial feeling about Jeff's art was kind of the way you're suggesting it, is that it's manufactured, you know, en masse and such. And when I met him, though, it's very disarming. He's really there. Every artist in this film is absolutely genuine about what they're doing. They really believe in what they're doing. Some of them are enormously market successful. Some of them aren't.
Yeah.
But they all believe in what they're doing. And right. Jeff is absolutely, you know, committed to what he's doing. There's no question. And I think Work Like the Bunny, when you see it, it is absolutely remarkable. It looks like, you know, it somehow it has this little tiny belly button in the, you know, this place where it was inflated.
Oh, yeah.
It actually has no belly button. It wasn't born. It was inflated.
Yeah.
You know, it just kind of grew from, you know, from the breath of God knows where. And it does have an incredible power to it because it has this kind of banality to it. And in fact, he has a series called the Banality Series. It seems banal, but then you're kind of in the presence of it for a while. And you think, wow, it is pretty amazing. And it somehow characterizes, it's commenting on our age.
Yeah.
So Jeff is somebody who I feel is enormously important for today because he speaks so much to our values directly. Now, most people can't get away with that because you start to, you know, you're too obvious about it and it falls flat. But with Jeff's best work, I think it actually feels like this is an artist who's directly engaged with our preoccupations and throws it back at us and says, is that really what you believe? Is this beautiful? Is that beautiful? What do you love? So, you know, Jeff is a marvelous character. He's extremely important in the film, but he is a counterpoint, you're right,
yeah.
to someone like Larry Poons. Now, and Jeff's success, of course, has been stratospheric, and he has that marketing genius, and yeah. We say it in the film. He really has that.
Yeah, no artists. I'll make that clear. As you just said, come across as slinging hash or as having sold out or anything like that. They're all players, and we should say this is an important part of the film. You actually film artists like George Kondo and Marilyn Minter. You mentioned doing their work.
Oh, absolutely. That was
talking
essential.
With them and engaging them. The Kondo stuff is particularly great, I have to say. As
yes.
He puts together a
Oh, well, George, to watch George do a painting, I mean, also artists, one of the things that, you know, you're sort of touching around something really important here, which is that there is an element of fate. I mean, in all of our lives, fate plays a role and luck plays a role. And as Larry says, my only defense against fate is color. Such a marvelous comment.
Yeah.
Someone like George Kondo, who has always been very successful. I mean, he's sort of been in the market for many, many years. He works very quickly. So another thing is, you make the art you make, it might take a very long time to make it. Or you might be able to turn out a painting in a day.
Yeah.
And we watched George.
Before lunch.
Before lunch, right.
Right.
We watched George do a painting before lunchtime, and it's a marvelous painting.
Yep.
But that's him.
Yep.
It's not somebody else. It doesn't, if it takes a short time, it doesn't mean it's better or worse. And if it takes a long time, it doesn't mean it's better or worse. Woman One is a painting of de Kooning, which we now, you know, is like an icon of modern art. This is something that he put aside and he worked on for several years. He couldn't finish it, didn't know what it was. Is it a painting at all? It doesn't work. You know, I mean, he felt he was never really finished. And someone came, a critic came by and finally said, "What's that?" And he said, "Oh, I don't know what that is." You know, "Oh, no, that's done. That's great." So that's another thing we play with, is this element of time. And one has to understand that each artist has their own way and one must stick with that. And so seeing George make a painting throughout the film is just one way of dealing with this idea of time and art, which is so essential.
I want to ask you about, there's another, you keep asking these really difficult questions throughout the film. Alexander Nemiroff, an art historian that you interview, and Barbara Rose, she's another art historian, she's terrific in the film too. They keep raising these questions about how you put value on these, you know, that are clearly troubled by where things are headed in the art market today.
Yes.
And Nemiroff has, I want to play this moment where, and we're in, it's an interesting counterpoint to the contemporary art that we've been seeing in the film, and we see these classics, Rembrandt, Vermeer, and Nemiroff talking about contemplating price. How do you attach a price to something like this? And I want to play this moment and have you talk about
it
if we could. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Another moment from the film, The Price of Everything.
I don't even try to contemplate what these things would be worth. The pricelessness that makes for price in the world. This Vermeer, for example, has got it all over every valuation, professorial or commercial, that could ever be put upon it, because it deals in what it used to be called in times less defeated than ours, the soul. But it's a pie in the sky to believe that this is to be separated out from a culture that values things, that values materials, and that even can put a value on that which is immaterial, like light itself.
What's he worried about? Because he's, I think he's, there's a moment where you show him, I think it's quite brilliant, walking through a gallery of contemporary art as a kind of a contrast to the stuff that he's most used to or at least most comfortable with. And then he comes across a Kuhn's piece on the deck, Diamond. It's this great sculpture, which is pristine and kind of perfect, and that troubles him. But talk a little bit about this part of the film.
Well, I mean, Alexander is his father is a poet, Howard Nemiroff, and Alexander is a poet. So for me, what was so thrilling being with him as a character is we just sort of went to the Frick and put him in front of a painting, and he begins to speak to the painting, or the painting speaks to him, and then he speaks to us. And he feels very strongly that words are very important for the understanding of art. And that's kind of what he's almost like a medium. He channels the artist's feelings. And he channels what he feels, what, and he points things out that you might not have noticed. He's not a label reader, you know. I mean, people go to galleries these days and they read the label. They want to know who made the art and they want to know what it's worth. They price the room. Yeah. It's what it's called, pricing the room. Yeah. That's anathema to him. To him, art is this communication. And so when he stands in front of the Rembrandt, he talks about, oh my God, this thing is like irradiating me. I don't like the way this man is looking at me. It's too much. And that honesty is just too powerful to deal with. So, you know, how do you put a price on that? So he is really, in the end, he talks about the Vermeer, you know, specifically saying that, I mean, his line is so marvelous where he says, and you've just heard it, but this idea that in an age less defeated than ours, this would be called the soul. This painting is about the soul. It makes you weep, you know. I mean, he means it.
Yeah.
So his role in the film so much is to say, look, this art, whether it's old art, whether it's old master art, or whether it's contemporary art, like the Kuhn's on the roof, it's telling us about who we are. It's demanding something of us. And he's not, to be clear, Alexander's now using the Kunz in his lectures that he gives at Stanford. He told me this recently, because he loves what the piece does to him. He loves the impact that it has. That's communication. So Alexander is concerned about our age. He feels in many ways that we live in an age which is not concerned with the soul. It's concerned with the price, the money.
He's not an old codger who thinks all the old stuff is good and the new stuff isn't.
Not at all. He loves modern art, contemporary art. Absolutely. It's that he is really speaking. He's saying, look, this art is telling us about who we are as a people.
Yeah.
And I think that at its core, what I wanted most of all in this film is to make something that made us question our values and our age. And art is always how we've communicated our feelings about who we are and where we're going and what matters.
Yeah.
It's always how we've done it.
Right.
So
you're saying stop pricing the room. Just look at it and see what it means to you.
And see what it's saying to you.
Right.
Receive it. And so if this film does one thing, if it helps people to remember that what matters about art is that you receive the emotions and it helps you to feel where you are in your life. Are you living a good life? Are you doing the right things with your time? What really, really matters to you? Those are things that art can give us. And we sure as heck need right now to be thinking about those things. Those values, those questions of who we are, where we're going, what really matters. We need to take a good hard look at ourselves.
That's Nathaniel Kahn. He directed the film The Price of Everything, which is showing in the U.S. Documentary competition here at Sundance. It's going to be showing tomorrow night at 9 at the Park City Library. It's going to be Friday evening at the Park City Municipal Athletic and Rec Center. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUVR. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the filmmaker Nathaniel Kahn. We're talking about his film, which is at Sundance this year. It is called The Price of Everything. It's showing in the U.S. documentary competition at the festival. Joining us here in the studio at the community radio station KPCW here in Park City. Amy Capolazzo is an art dealer. Really charismatic.
Very.
Incredibly smart.
Oh, yeah. Powerful.
And powerful. That's a good way to put it. Talk a little bit about the role of the dealer. She's great because on one hand, she really kind of teaches us, I think, in the film about what is it that makes something valuable. You ask her that.
Sure.
She says, well, it's quality, it's rarity, it's the consensus among critics and others. And I mean, it's a really interesting kind of education, I have to say. Like, how is it that she does this evaluation? But then you interrogate her from time to time and she pushes back on you. It's a great relationship.
So.
I really like it. There's one moment where you say, you know, do you hope that these amazing paintings end up with, you know, basically good people? And she's like, well, I don't really like the moral qualifier you've put there.
She's right. She's right to call me on that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's good, but I'm glad you included that because that exchange is really interesting. Talk a little bit about Amy because in some ways she represents kind of the dealer perspective that they're trying to look at the aesthetic value, but then, of course, the commercial value.
It should be slightly sort of a dealer is somewhat different because usually an art dealer is like is a gallerist more. And Amy is she works at within the Sotheby's auction house, but she has her own. She's an art advisor as well.
Yeah.
So she definitely is somebody who helps people of means to connect with art that might be appropriate for them.
She loves the chase and the deal, she says.
She loves the chase and the deal.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's very genuine. I mean, one thing I want to say in this film is that the characters, the people who are in this film are all passionately committed to their part of what the art world. They're all, you know, in that sense, they represent their point of view very, very strongly. And she is somebody who, you know, who really loves the aspect of selling art. I mean, that's fun for her. She also loves art. And maybe we talk about that in a moment.
Yeah.
She deeply, deeply loves art. But, you know, she is very good at knowing how to put together an auction. She puts together auction catalogs.
Yeah, we see this in the film, the play-out.
Part of her job. I mean, she has a very, very broad-ranging interaction with the art world. She knows artists. She loves artists, too. But we do see one of the key things in a film like this is finding a clock, finding something which you can string through the film, which tends to give people a sense of, okay, where are we going?
Yep.
So one of the stories, we had so many characters and they all have their own stories, and that's difficult. To make that work. There are geniuses at it like Robert Altman. I'm not nearly at that level, but he has inspired me because he manages to do something like in Nashville where multiple characters are able to kind of – you're tied together because one meets the next and the next one meets the other one and that sort of thing. But it's in a bounded world in that case of the country music scene. In this case, it's the art world.
Yep.
And one of the –
And the thing I'll say, it works. Well, there is narrative momentum in this piece.
Absolutely. Yep. No, there certainly is. And one of the things, of course, each character has an arc.
Yep.
And they intersect.
Yep.
But another one that's very strong is the putting together of an auction. So we watch Amy put together an auction, and we're behind the scenes seeing how she evaluates paintings, works of art, and puts them into a catalog. How you comparative image them with other works from the past. I mean, this is out of the real estate playbook too, right? I mean,
yep.
It's a comp.
Yep.
It is a comparable thing. It's something you think, the values, you should be thinking about this when you're thinking about this particular painting.
Yep.
And comping works is utterly essential in the auction world for getting customers to say, oh, gee, I want one of those. But watching her put those things together is fascinating because we get into this idea of how do you put a price? If you're going to put a price on art, how do you do it?
Yeah.
And I think one of the things we like to do in the film is it's also a bit of a visual smorgasbord, a bit of a visual education in the sense that you see works that look like you're able to do your own comps in your head and say, well, gee, that looks kind of like a Larry Poons. Why is this Larry Poons not valuable like that? What's going on here? So there is this aspect of they're kind of making it up.
There's a moment when, in the way I'm thinking about the film, looking at it, I see Amy as this clearly devoted to art. But then there's a moment when she almost seems like just a stockbroker. There's this really clinical way of looking at it. And then this moment comes in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a brilliant thing. You ask her this question, and then it all comes back around to what really matters for her.
Yes.
You're in a taxi cab,
I think. Oh, my gosh. It's a marvelous scene. And it just makes me love her.
What was the first piece that you fell in love with?
Like, beyond something I made as a child that I loved, or, like something that was real art in that way?
She saw it, yeah.
My hometown museum has this Giacomo Balla painting that's very famous. And it's a dog, a little kind of like long-haired dachshund, like wagging its tail and like its feet are going, and a woman's dress is moving. And it's that movement, that very futurist movement of Balla. It's a famous picture. Masterpiece, loved that. I thought that was just so amazing. Want me to show you a picture of it?
Yeah.
Super famous painting at the Albright Knox, like Buffalo, New York. It's such a masterpiece. I loved that painting. Look at it, how great it is. The dog is just magnificent. I happen to love dogs. So I'm gonna screen capture this so I can look at it on a bad day.
Great.
When I'm having a day, I'm gonna look at that painting. That's great.
I mean, she loves it so much. She's like, let me show you a picture of it in this cab.
And she does, and we filmed it.
I know. It's so great.
And it's a perfect painting, too, because one of the things I love about that painting, it's from 1912. I mean, one of the things in this film is we are trying to provide a wide range of art historical, images and everything else. So this painting was sort of perfect. It's from 1912. It's by Giacomo Balla, as you mentioned, and it shows a dog on a leash, but he's trying to represent the movement of the dog, and it represents the beginning of cinema. It's like 24 frames a second. This dog is wagging its tail, and the leash is going around, and that she loves that painting. You realize, okay, this may be a person who's involved with selling art, but they also really love art. So that is, I mean, that's the complexities of everybody in this film is what really makes me feel good about the fact that these people are all in one container.
Yeah.
There's nobody who's simple. There's no, and I'm not, I don't judge these people. These are people who are engaged in this remarkable microcosm of our world. And at the end of the day, whatever you think about the art market and the money and all those things, and there is an aspect of it that is really disturbing. At the end of the day, art matters.
Let's talk about one more artist. And she's such an important – she's an up-and-comer. She's remarkable. Angelica Akonyili Crosby.
Yes.
Is her name. She's this Nigerian-born artist who works out of Los Angeles, where she lives.
Yep.
And there's a moment as it goes throughout the film where we see a painting. One of hers is coming up for auction.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this – I want to play this moment where you hand her your computer and you show her the auction as it's playing out for her piece.
Yes.
As it keeps going up and
yes.
up and up. And people won't be able to see her reaction, so we'll just play this moment and we'll talk about it.
Because
sure. It really gets at a couple of things. Let's play this moment from the film The Price of Everything.
850,000. There it is at 850. It's 850,000. 900,000 now. At $900,000. It's with Alex at the desk, and I'm going to sell it this time. Fair warning. At $900,000. Thank you, Alex. L0075. And thank you, Amy, to your bidder as well. Thank you very much indeed.
So she's looking at it. She's looking at the computer right
yes.
now.
Yes.
She
yes.
has that little sigh. And that little...
that change in the sound goes from when we're in the auction room
right.
to her watching
right.
it on the computer.
How'd you describe that? Yeah. So this two things to me come up here. One, how much of that $900,000 did she get? Ask her that.
I mean, Njideka is an incredible artist. How much of this $900,000 goes to her? The answer is zero.
Yeah.
Nothing. Not a penny. So that she is able to watch this piece that she, you know, sold a while ago. It's a beautiful piece called Drown. And we follow the piece as it goes to auction mm-hmm. and as people are fascinated by it. Many, many people bidding for it. There's kind of a bidding war for it. And she watches it with this kind of impassive look of like, wow, that has nothing to do with me
exactly.
whatsoever. And with her, it's absolutely genuine. She knows that she has to face the blank canvas the next day and start all over again because her motivation, and she talks about this in the film too, so much of it is visibility, is being able to communicate your point of view. And how do you do that to a lot of people? And this is a profound problem with collectors in the sense that a collector has it, they put it in storage or they put it on their wall. You know, will it get seen?
Yeah.
And if you really care about communication, you want your work in museums. And that's she feels very strongly about that. And luckily, a great deal of her work is in museums. And she's very careful to make sure as much as she can that that is what is happening. Now, that having been said, there are great collectors out there. And she's also very conscious of wanting to be in those collections. But, I, you know, you have to speak to her to fully understand
yeah.
that. But I think she represents the soul of a young artist who is absolutely committed to her process and her work. And she's hanging on to that. And that is just magnificent to see.
Let me ask you finally, we hear from throughout the film various dealers who are wondering where we're headed, the art market, the art world right now. Among them is this dealer named Gavin Brown. And he asks, he says in the film, he says, art is having a hard time getting its way out of this situation right now.
Yeah.
We're careening towards some kind of end game or something, he says. I think I can smell smoke, he says.
Yes, yes.
Where do you think we are headed finally? I mean, I think there's some sense of how can it get bigger? Is it going to – and I don't mean the market. I mean
sure.
the way, as you say, you want people to come back around to that, to looking at something for not for its, you know, its monetary value but for something else. But
sure.
where do you think we're headed in that sense, I suppose?
Well, I think there is a reckoning going on. I think there really is. I think we're in a terrible crisis in the world. You know, the 1% has way too much and the rest of everybody else has way too little. And if we don't find a way to work that out in our culture, we're headed for disaster. I mean, we really are. And I think art is showing us that. And that's in the end, that's what Nemirov's message is too. That we have to remember that, you know, the value of the really important things in the world cannot be bought and sold. They just can't. They're, you know, it's love. It's connection between people. It's compassion. You know, there's no, you can't, that they're priceless. And they truly are priceless. You can't put a price on them. However, you've got to find money to keep a station like this open. We have to find a way to protect those beautiful mounds out there. And that does take money. So we do have to spend money on things that matter. But in order to know where we should be spending the money, we sure got to get our values worked out. So in the end, the price of everything, the value of nothing, is saying, look, we need to figure out what is really worth our attention in the world. And I think with art, go to a museum and realize that so many of these places, these insights, in many cases, are for free. You stand there in front of a Rembrandt. You know, I mean, yes, there is a small thing to pay to get into the Frick. It's true. I mean, there are institutions that you know, they have to survive too. But you stand in front of that, and all of that passion, all of that beauty, all of that life that man lived, that Rembrandt lived, his suffering, the guy died basically bankrupt. And he was rich at one time. He spent it the wrong way. Whatever happened, there were scandals in his life, all these things. He's looking at you with those eyes. And that's him. That's a piece of him. And so when, you know, these artists are communicating that you see in this film, they want that connection with us. So in the end, that's the thing to take away, that the best things in life, really, we can't put a price on, but we've got to spend our money, find a way to spend our money in smarter ways to protect the things that really, really matter.
It's Nathaniel Kahn. He directed the documentary film The Price of Everything, which is showing at the U.S. documentary competition at the Sundance Film Festival this year. Still two screenings of the film available in Park City. We have details about that on our website, radiowest.org. Nathaniel Kahn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to the staff at community radio station KPCW here in Park City. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.